Welcome to IN, a podcast series dedicated to contemporary visual art practices. IN is brought to you by New Local Space, a contemporary art initiative in Kingston, Jamaica, also presenting art residencies, curatorial fellowships, and exhibitions.
This is episode 41 of IN, the fourth in a series of recordings of the convening of artists and curators that took place in Kingston on Saturday, May 27.
Philip Thomas was born in Kingston, Jamaica. Upon graduating with a Bachelor's of Fine Arts from Edna Manley College of the Visual and Performing Arts in Kingston, Jamaica, Philip Thomas received a grant from the Cobb Family Foundation, as well as a scholarship from the Chase Fund, to study and complete a master's degree in New York. He completed his studies at the New York Academy of Art, where he graduated at the top of his class and was awarded a fellowship from the Academy. At the end of his master's and during his fellowship year, Philip produced works that dealt with issues of colonialism in the Caribbean and many of the issues of classism that persist in Jamaica and the New World today. Thank you for being here, Philip.
All right, thank you very much. Thanks for the invitation. I appreciate it very much. So I want to start by saying that I'm going to improvise on my original presentation, because I think a profound question was asked earlier by Brian. Where is Brian? Is somewhere. Yes. The first question, not the second one. And the thing about the first question, why it was so important, was basically, can art affect change in the society as an instrument of change, right? And various people responded in both terms. So I want to actually quote something by James Haquil. And Haquil, who was what's known as an itinerant painter, but he's really a colonialist. And he was sent to Jamaica to sort of do landscape paintings to send back to England so that prospective buyers, slavers, whoever it is that can come and see the actual land. And Haquil, in his book, A Picturesque Tour of Jamaica, I think the title of the book is, where he talks about the way one produces painting in the New World is to strip the land of civilization. And he says it explicitly, where he actually believes that art has the ability to craft a kind of people for subjugation, right? So if the colonizer believe that art can craft a land and craft a people, then the people that create the antidote must also believe that, right? And so that's kind of where I wanted to start. And so basically, when you think about Jamaican art, you're looking at how people have come to look at the land, how people that live and work on the land see the land, and how people, and also how said people that work and live on the land make work of art for personal consumption or for export, right? And so those bands, in a way, create different modes of expression, different ways we go about crafting the idea of art. How do we present ourselves to ourselves, and how do we present ourselves through notions of consumption? I'll talk maybe later on about things like tourism and all the other things like that. So I would say up until 1960, pre- and post-independent artists were primarily concerned with notions of nationalism. How does the artist go about crafting this idea of a new Jamaica, a new country, a new culture, a new way of thinking and seeing quote-unquote free people, right? And then right up until about 1980, as you heard, that's the year I was born. And it is said in the literature that's the most violent period in Jamaican political life, right? Hundreds of dead. I mean, I hear my father talk about it all the time. The amount of places that were burnt down with people in it. You know what I mean? And so that sort of violence created, I think, a snap in the art world, in how we've gone about the idea of the promise that Jamaica was supposed to be. And so all the artists, and I'm glad Brian is here, but his entire generation shifted away from what their parents did, the kind of hope that nationalism brought through independence. And they developed a kind of a new, almost national skepticism. And that skepticism has, in a way, existed up until this point. So all that you see in contemporary art is birthed out of a sort of uncertainty that the 80s brought. And all of those guys, they became our lecturers, they wrote all the books for us, it became the de facto position. So when you look at contemporary Jamaican art, one of the first things that you'll come upon is the idea of a kind of national doubt, almost. And so this painting, no, don't worry about it. I would say this is my, okay. So the painting that this was influenced by was a painting that I don't have the image for it. At that time, I didn't do a lot of documentation as an Edna Manley student. But it was a painting that was titled Brayton 7. And at the time, just when I graduated from the Edna Manley College, 7 young men were executed in a house in not so far from where I live, in Portmore. And that became a sort of national sentiment, right? And so I was making a sort of thinking about the idea of state violence, and that's something that's a recurring theme in my work. How is it that we understand what the state is, what the citizen is, and how do we respond to these instances of state violence nationally? So of course, across the board in the country, everyone sort of had, it was almost a kind of George Floyd moment for us, where people were reacting to the kind of almost mass casualty in one sitting. And when you go to the people that live in Brayton, it was kind of a sigh of relief that they were gone. And so for me, the society sort of split between the local experience of gang culture, gun culture, and the nationalistic experience of what we call state brutality, state violence. And somewhere in between that, there is a kind of truth that I think a lot of artists kind of strive to articulate. So the second version of this, and this was made in New York, actually, when I started to think about immigration and how immigration became a part of how people of the Caribbean tend to deal with problems of, as we say, broadening our rights, are leaving our shores in order to export. It's a kind of export mentality that we have when it comes to how we think about immigration, right? And so this painting, the N train, right? So I lived in Brooklyn on the N line, and this train went through some of the poorest communities. It made me almost wonder what the N stand for on N train. And so I was making this painting, thinking about how immigrant culture had to, in a way, huddle and remake the culture that they came from. So you have the Jamaican community, and you have the Dominican, you have all these different various communities that once you come from a particular place in the Caribbean, you sort of reform the same group, but in a separate place. Right, next slide. Oh, I see. Oh. Right, so I'll go on to the next point. So, right, here it is. So contemporary postmodern nationalism. So much of what I've made from about 2003 to now dealt primarily with not just immigration through nationalism, but what I call a kind of aesthetic immigration. In terms of the inner circle of our culture. So how do we go between different demographics, and how do we document those kinds of differences between people? So this work, yes, we have met before, is I started to do these, what I call gardens. And if you notice, just at the base, there's this sort of astroturf, and you can see a lot of gardening tools, things like that. And I started to look at how gardens function as a kind of liminal space between the notion of the great house and the fields. And in that space, where the so-called homeowner and the enslaved from the fields would sort of co-mingle in this kind of gardening work. And I thought of the Caribbean as a kind of grand garden that sits between these two locations of strife and power. And so a lot of the emancipatory struggle engage within this in-between space. Next slide, please. And so for scale reference, as I give you this installation shot to give you a sense of the scale, because I started to do some research on how is it that Jamaican art became physically what we know it as over the past 60 years, let's say. And it turns out that because Jamaica had a huge mercantile class that sits outside of the National Gallery or any kind of public institutions, that constraint in a way physically designed Jamaican art in a particular way. And so up to 90% of what was produced between, let's say, 1950 and 1975 sat between 2.5 feet by 5 feet. And there's an auction coming up. And if you go to that auction, almost everything is in that space. So if you look at the broad swath of Jamaican art, it sits specifically designed almost for living room settings, right? And so the first thing I started to do when I came back home, I started to make paintings 20 feet, 30 feet by 14 feet. And so it almost as a kind of push against the notion of domesticity in art, because that was a huge part of our art economy. Next slide. And so here's another version that was at the National Gallery. And again, as you can see, the ideas, for whatever reason, Jamaicans pride their lands, and it is imperative that the sign keep off grass. It's almost a holy place for a lot of people in Jamaica. And so again, you can see all the gardening tools and all the what I call first tools of rebellion, because every rebellion right across the world, the people that voice the rebellion are always using gardening tools, every one of them, right? Whether it's in Russia, China, Jamaica, right across the Caribbean, that's the standard. Next slide. Oh, and this is a close-up of the centerpiece. Tank. So this painting I made in response to the Tivoli incursion. As you guys may know, there was a military intervention in terms of what they say an extradite Jamaica's quote-unquote don or strongman downtown. And this was a kind of a response to how Muhammad Ali would say he doesn't want to go to Vietnam to go and fight people that he's not being oppressed by. And so imagine the soldiers having to go into a place to level a bunch of just residents, just innocent people trying to live their life, just to get out a single man. And so this contention, it sort of brought me back to what was happening in Britain 7, that disconnect between what the state see as a group of people and what the locals see as the same group of people. And so that discrepancy I've always found to be an interesting tension between national expectations and local expectations, the individual, the one-on-one expectation. Next slide. Okay. And again, a similar relationship between how do we juxtapose what's happening in the background. And I wish I had details to show you exactly how some of these things are constructed, because if you can notice in the background, the paintings are painted on these, what they call toile fabrics. They're sort of like garden scenes, again, to echo the notions of the garden. But I would then go into these scenes and sort of disrupt or break the narrative of what the original scene was like. So I would put lynched figures, I'd put things like police brutality, I'd put all sorts of things that almost disagree with the foreplay of the painting. So you have a sort of tension between what we put in the backgrounds of our society and what we present in the foreground of our society. And so that tension is something that you'll see as a consistent thing throughout my work. And at the base, as you can see, there are lots of hints of military conflict. And that's a continuous theme that you'll see right throughout my work. Problems of military conflict, problems of strife, problems of police injustice. And also, if you look at the images, and I don't know if how many of you have been to barbershops, but you will see these, what you call, like hairstyles that you should select or choose from. But each one of these are, you know, my fellow artists. And so it's a kind of way of thinking, how do I, the artists that I respect and I admire, how do I almost craft their mind onto my, how do I take a kind of these ideas and the things that I find really important in the work and think about it as something that I can use as a, almost a kind of way of thinking. Next slide. Right. And this is a friend of mine, Kimani Beckford, said this is one of his favorite works. Again, a kind of juxtaposition between what's happening in the background, a kind of panorama of history. And as you can see at the very top there, the guy I mentioned at the opening, Kay Quill's paintings show up. And so the problem of crafting one's own narrative, again, is something that a lot of my paintings kind of articulate. Go again. Right, and I think I'm going to stop. I can't remember if there are other paintings after this, but I'm going to stop after this one to move to the projects that we've been working on. So this particular painting, a few years ago, a student of mine, again, found himself confronted by state violence. And he was, with a couple of his friends, painting a mural in a volatile area in Kingston. And it so happened that there was a conflict between gang members and the police. And so once the gunfire started, the vehicle that they came in, they decided, okay, we're going to leave. And by the time they came around the corner and tried to leave the scene, they were blocked at the exit by the police and the military. And the guys just came out and just opened fire on the car. And the driver was killed, but my student was very badly wounded, and he's still in recovery. And it's something that, you know, I've thought about it because it was one of those moments where it's almost, it's so difficult to comprehend this unnecessary state of violence just on a group of students trying to paint a mirror, produce an artwork, right? And so this painting was based on Vladimir Estragon contemplating state violence in Jamaica. I don't know if you remember who Vladimir Estragon is. There are two figures in a play called Waiting for Godot by Samuel Beckett. And so almost the madness, the incomprehensibility of that kind of state is something that I used as a trigger to almost frame something that I cannot quite put my mind around. And again, in the background, you can see, for instance, some of the silhouettes where the guy has his hand up and the policeman is kind of pointing at him, the sort of hands up, don't shoot, a metaphor almost. And so when you look at what's happening in the background, it's almost contradictory to the stillness and the silence of the foreground. Next slide. Yeah, let's get it. So Camille, Cheddar, and myself, and three more artists started a group where we started to produce exhibitions. We started it during the pandemic, and it was an interesting thing to try and, as it were, almost flout the law when the lockdown started to try and put on these exhibitions. But Jamaica Painting Now are the preceding talks that I started to ask artists to come and give presentations on their work and help the students kind of understand how it is that one transitions from a student to an artist, almost like what Onika does with Life After Art School. It kind of functions in a similar way. And so a lot of these presentations I've done usually has more established artists and students. It's almost a sort of mixed bag. which allows students to sort of transition from school into the world of professional art. Next slide. And so here is an example. This is at the Edna Manley College. Next slide. Next slide. Okay, right. And so this, I think this is the final slide. No, it's not. Okay. So this is the flyer for the exhibitions we've been having. I think, how many is it now? Four in the series? And so it's an ongoing thing where we're, I mean, I don't necessarily consider myself a curator in any way. I sort of think about what it is that artists would want and how do artists see themselves? What would be the best way for artists to function in a space, right? And sometimes that might differ, and I find that quite often that differs from what the curator wants. And so that difference is something that I'm sort of grappling with. I have the utmost respect for curators. I don't know how you deal with artists. It's kind of a new skill I'm trying to figure out. But next slide. Right, and so that this is the, so except Larry Osaimenta, who's an American curator, this is the rest of us that sort of put this show together. And I'm glad to see a couple of the artists here who have been in this exhibition too. Is that the last one? Okay. Opening night. Oh, and this is in Miami, actually. So what I did this last December, so we did two versions of it. And we had another leg of the exhibition shown open in Miami at the same time that we did one here in Jamaica. Oh. That's so many things I put in there. Okay, this is the last thing. We're not going beyond this. So I had an opportunity. Oh, there's the video. We don't need the video. No, we're running late. So the This is fine. So I was asked to do a presentation for the Harvey B. Gantt Center for the Arts. And I thought, because I wanted to just have a presentation on my work and my practice in general, and I thought it would be a better idea to host that presentation at the National Gallery. And the gallery was very gracious to allow me the space to set up and sort of showcase not just my work, but the Biennale itself. And that, I think, is how I generally go about how I interface with the art world, not from an individualistic point of view, but how can one use whatever platform they have to sort of broaden how we present or how we find linkages between different institutions on our own. Right? All right, that's it. I don't want to go beyond that. All right, thanks. Yeah.
Use this one mic. Anybody has any questions for Philip?
Yes. Thanks. The headless characters, the first images you showed of your paintings, is there a symbolism behind the headless characters?
I used to do a lot of bullfighter paintings, right? And oftentimes I would sympathize with the bull. You know, because bullfighting, a lot of people don't realize, it's almost a metaphor for colonialism. You know what I mean? And so I used to, in a way, have the costuming of the matador and sort of empty out the costumes and just sort of have these just figures parading without an actual body in it. Right? A sort of almost a machinery. And it's something that you see in a lot of my other works where there's a kind of just a figure presence but not an actual mind. And that, again, is a kind of juxtaposition between the people that are that have bodies as opposed to the people without, or people that are just part of the machinery as opposed to the people that have individualism.
I think I'll use this opportunity to ask a question that I've never gotten an answer from Philip's work, because it's so layered, and also, of course, his language is so layered. But your appearance throughout the paintings is seemingly highly significant, and it's many of the images, the people portrayed who have faces sometimes look like you, and it's a particular deadpan stare with a suit, as though there's a kind of character. And I would just love to hear a little bit about that.
That's a good question. Because I'm trained as a painter, in a way, a part of that training stems from self-portraiture. And it's how do you oscillate between you a self-portrait and using yourself as a model? And sometimes there's slippage between those two things. Sometimes I'm representing myself, also, and other times I'm representing a sort of stand-in for Black Jamaican male or Jamaica. You know, it's sort of sometimes personal or national or racial. And so depending on the work you're looking at, it sort of oscillates between these things. That also comes from part of the experience in painting bullfighters, this kind of presentation. It's an almost reductive, militaristic, and because I'm so interested in militarism, the kind of suit almost becomes a uniform. It's indistinguishable. You know what I mean? And this kind of, because it's so indistinguishable, one can almost create this uniformity and strip the figure of individualism. You mean, so kind of use it as a camouflage almost. In a way, in one of the things I had to think very carefully about, and when I was doing my master's on the problem of painting, let's say, the problem in the sense that it comes with a particular kind of narrative and a particular kind of baggage that's attached to that narrative. And this, in a way, goes back to the earlier question that Brian asked. If it is that you are using a particular language, and that language is, in a way, the language that was used for subjugation for the person that was making the work, then there is now a particular tension between how do I find ways in using the language, but also pulling it apart and reorganizing it in the way we use language now, right? I mean, I remember listening to Mama G, for instance, saying that she felt so saddened not being able to communicate to another person just because of this language barrier. And I wrote, just in responding to that sensation, if I could find it here. Yes, language is a part of the cartography through which we experience colonialism. And her sentiment made me feel that. Like, here's somebody that wants to communicate a particular thing, but then there's this filter through which the thing must be communicated. And the receiver of the thing then takes on not just what you're saying, but the baggage of the language. Painting operates in a very similar way, where because of the very history of it, it is produced in one way and received in sometimes the same way or in different ways. And the artist has to figure out a way how to understand the perception of the history of painting in order to be able to navigate through it, because the subject that you're trying to articulate is not necessarily constructed in this language. And so you have to, in a way, use the language to create different metaphors. And sometimes the language, there's a kind of tension between what is said and how it's said, because you're trying to strip the viewer from seeing how paintings are traditionally seen in order to be able to say clearly what it is that you're trying to say. So, and this is why, I mean, to talk about the research aspect of it, I have to go through copious amounts of text, and this is why Haquil came to mind in how he writes about the process of painting and its ability to strip cultures of dignity.
That answered my question that I was going to ask about the repetition of the images in your work, because each one of them I actually see in certain images that I have already seen in some of the works,
right,
and how they are placed within the work itself.
You're sort of building a kind of language or a kind of way you've gone about a particular kind of expression. And so it's how you craft this visual language that makes it part of your own way of seeing, that's particular to you and particular to the subject that you're trying to express. And so you'll see, and so it's not necessarily just about repetition, but even in language, the way words and phrases are reused but reconfigured to mean something completely different. So it's just almost the raw material that you're identifying as part of the topography of the work, then, let's say.
Hi, Philip. The question I have is based on the work that you were saying that was inspired by somebody getting shot, a student of yours.
Yeah.
Because somebody asked you as well about the suits, and I noticed that the work is inspired by that incident, and it happened in, you know, inner city community. So what's the relationship between class and your work, and how that relate back to the student? And is it a mere fact that there's this, I don't know, because you know what suits represent. So you know what I mean? Especially amongst men and how it looks. So I want to know what, you know what I'm gonna say.
All right. Let me make sure. So in Jamaican music, you'll often hear the phrase, and it goes back to your question, you'll hear it over and over again as a kind of iconography, Mr. Jacket and Tie. And every time you hear that phrase in music or in literature or wherever it is, it represents a particular managerial class in Jamaica. And that often speaks to that kind of class. It's almost a symbol of a kind of classism in Jamaica. And so the juxtaposition that you're talking about has to do with, if you can go back to the image. And this is why what happens in the background is almost in opposition to what happens in the foreground of almost a lot of my works, because it creates the tension between what it is that is truly happening in the society and the managerial ways in which we go about dealing with the problems. Almost a kind of extracting out of the empathy of the subject to deal with it in a kind of almost business-oriented way. And so you have to think about it, you know, in things like racism and classism and colonialism. In order for those things to function in the way they did, they had to be approached almost in a kind of brutalist business sense. You know, almost the kind of emotionalism extracted in order to be able to carry out the kind of brutality. So first, the enslaved people have to be dehumanized. And once you strip people of their humanity, then comes the managerial ways. And you see the same thing in Nazi Germany, in the way how there was an attempt to strip humanity first in order so I can just deal with it by numbers. And so that numeracy is how you strip away humanity. And so the suit often operates as a kind of, again, as I said before, a kind of militarism. You know, an unidentifiable man in a suit with a briefcase, with a, you know, whatever. It can be any business, any profession, whatever it is, but the interaction is one of pure, I did an exhibition once called Civil Savages, and so just to put those two words together, kind of civility, but there's a kind of brutality under it, a kind of almost dehumanized way of interaction.
You know, your work, as always, I really admire your work. And in looking at them, I just think the people in the foreground are just mannequins. It's not what you want, because they have no life. They're posed, they're immaculate. And I wonder to myself, well, Philip, you've been on this sort of theme for a long time. I'm going to challenge you. Can you do another painting or a series of painting just spontaneously, without any research, without any overlay of history?
Margaret, again, it goes back to how one approaches the problem of painting. And Onika said it before in her presentation, the idea of the drawing as a study for the painting. And so there's this kind of systematicity in how one produces work, but this particular kind of work, right? Now, it is part of the problem with the traditional arts is the idea that there is a kind of seamlessness or kind of discipline, let's say, to how one goes about producing it, right? It's a kind of mechanism, a kind of almost a machinery in how it's produced. And if you skip any of the parts, then you're sort of not operating in the best sense of the tradition. And that is a fair point. But the thing is, I actually don't work like that. It ends up looking like that, but I actually work in a very haphazard way. In fact, I used to drive my professors in New York crazy because how I go about producing works of art has nothing to do with how the formal ways of producing traditional paintings operate. And that's something I've studied for a long time, for instance. And I used to do a lot of, for instance, they had this course where you had to go and study traditional painting, and they take you to the back of the Metropolitan Museum and you go through all the entire topography of the work, and you go through all the chemistry of it and all the science of it. I almost ignore all of that in how I go about making painting. But it's an important way of understanding, almost a kind of archaeological way of understanding how works of art are, one time or another, is approached. I, on the other hand, as I say, fuse it with many different avenues. For instance, the fabric in the background and how the figures are achieved on it. It's a particular way I had to go about devising how to paint within a very particular system in order to get the imagery in particular places and to avoid other things. You know? So technically there are things that I'm doing that are not as streamlined. As for the history of it, the very subject itself requires that kind of a study or research in order to be able to put together these disparate notions, then, let's say.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Philip.